Hello, listeners, and welcome to part three of Vanishing Season by Katie Darby, read by Katie Darby. The story so far is that James Emerson, history undergraduate at Cambridge, has been invited down to the tiny Suffolk hamlet of Wenniston by his former friend, Chester Whittingstall, who's the vicar there. However, when he arrives on a blazing hot summer's day in 1892, he's informed by the verger that Chester has disappeared and he has not been seen for 2 days. The locals seem strangely unconcerned about this, but the medieval painting which Emerson came to view, the Wenniston Doom, is very much still there. So we've just had a long account of his viewing and reaction to the painting itself. He's now, evening is drawing in, and he's sitting down to sketch some of the more unusual aspects of the picture. I suppose I must have fallen into a sort of trance or reverie, as sometimes happens when one becomes entirely engrossed by some absorbing pursuit. Yet I confess that neither reading, music, nor intensive study had ever consumed me thus. I would have sworn that no more than 15 minutes elapsed as I attempted to copy the detail and shading of the hairy devils in the picture, but when I felt Oxborough's broad hand upon my shoulder and saw his blunt, anxious face looming into mine, I realised that some considerable time must have passed. "Sorry I took so long coming back, sir," he was saying, "but there's been foxes in the churchyard these last few nights. I've to scare 'em away. I had to chase off a few midnight mourners, too." Midnight mourners? My eyes were sear and stinging, as if I had not blinked between first sitting down and this moment. I closed them, and traces of red and yellow fire lingered behind the lids. "You'll see," he said shortly, and ushered me out, pushing the draughty window shut by main force, and locking the vestry door with practised swiftness. Glancing up my watch, at first I could make no sense of the hour it told before realising with resignation that there was no possible prospect of my leaving Wenniston tonight. "I'm afraid I must ask you to put me up for the evening, Oxborough," I said contritely. I felt the biggest fool imaginable for imposing in this fashion after having insisted I must be gone with the last train. Of course, Whittingstall's servants had been instructed to accommodate me in every particular, but I had hoped not to prove so troublesome a guest. He nodded, as if he had expected this. "Guest room at the rectory is always made up. Time flies when you've work doing, eh, sir?" "Indeed," I murmured, though I felt that it had not so much flown as vanished altogether. What had I done while I stared and sat, looking at the ancient image? I could not remember completing a drawing, though it seemed my pencil had never been out of my hand. I reached to my inner pocket to draw out the pad and examine my sketches.
"There it is, sir,"
said the verger suddenly, halting my hand. He stopped still and pointed to a recent grave, piled with fresh earth and strewn with flowers and tributes. I thought it looked rather picturesque, with the petals' pallor glowing beneath the fitful moon, but Oxborough's expression was thunderous. He strode across the turf and plucked up something which had been carefully laid against the headstone.
"Oh, these Wenniston folk, some of them. The weeks after burial they leave food and such for their dead."
"Do they indeed?" An image came to me of Egyptian and Anglo-Saxon burial rites, the corpse equipped and victualled for its journey to the underworld.
"Aye," he muttered darkly, "'tis a downright nuisance, and I've chased them off time and again, but they keep coming back."
"Surely it's a harmless custom," I protested, if a little morbid.
"Harmless?"
he cried, shaking the object, which looked remarkably like a fine meat pie, in my direction.
"Why, 'tis what brings the foxes. We never had 'em here before, but now there's tidbits on the grave mounds. It's a banquet for the beasts."
Half crushing the pie, which I was sorry to see so abused, in his large fist, he spun on his heel and hurled it out of the churchyard, towards the thickly wooded hill that rose beyond.
"Here," he cried, "have that for your supper, you sneaking reynards."
I knew not how to respond to this display of savage temper, so said nothing, reminding myself that what with Whittingstall's disappearance and scouring the church's grounds of feral scavengers, the poor fellow's patience must have been sorely tried of late.
"Vicar never liked it neither," he murmured, almost as an afterthought. "Nasty, superstitious nonsense. Wouldn't happen in Saxmundham, and that's a fact."
And he stumped away up the moon-bright path towards the rectory, obliging me to hurry to keep pace. Nightfall had, alas, brought no perceptible coolness, and the warm, windless air parted sluggishly before me, the slightest exertion causing me to swelter. I had not thought it possible for the remote countryside to be as hot as the reflecting stone citadel of Cambridge, but Weniston was proving me wrong. Oxborough knocked upon the rectory door, and as we awaited the housekeeper's answer, leaned against the wall of the porch and began again absently to whistle that haunting little tune, Wandering Jim. My reaction must have shown in my face, for he ceased with some abruptness and asked me what was the matter.
"Are you well, sir? You look like someone stepped over your grave, as we say."
"It is nothing," I assured him, "only that song. Where have you heard it?" Missing teeth shadowed his grin.
"Where ain't I, you might better ask. Why, it's an old air from hereabouts. Knowed it since I was knee-high."
"Oh, I see. I thought you might have picked it up from from Mr. Whittingstall. He used always to hum it when I knew him at Cambridge. It was rather his theme."
Now he put his head back and roared.
"Lord bless you, sir. 'Tis common as daisies around these parts. Besides, Vicar's a local lad, ain't he?"
"Is he?" Chester had never talked much about his people, but there were several ancient and distinguished families in the county, and I suppose the Whittingstalls might well belong to one of those.
"Aye, not Weniston, of course, but one of the villages. Somewhere round about Bury, if I recollect. He'd have learned it in his crib, like us all."
"Indeed," I said, drifting deep into the waters of contemplation. I was coming slowly to understand, with no little surprise and reluctance, that there was much I had yet to learn about the friend I'd believed I knew so well.
"Well, sir," Oxborough said, as the rectory door at last yawned wide, "I'll bid ye good night."
He nodded to the housekeeper, who pursed her lipless mouth by way of acknowledgement.
"Mrs. Tydell?"
"And a good night to you," I began to say, but he had already vanished into the sultry torpor of the evening. All that remained was for me to follow the silent housekeeper up high-windowed stairs to the guest room. I recall that her coarse grey bun caught in the moonlight like a hank of sheep's wool upon a fence, and I had the absurd, fleeting impression that I was pursuing a bobbing will-o'-the-wisp through the hushed house, rather than any person of flesh and blood. "Good night, sir," she said in her colourless thread of a voice, leaving me at the threshold. Did I imagine the glint of apprehension flashing in her watery eyes as she wished me pleasant dreams? I suppose I ought to have anticipated, when I parted the tight-drawn curtains to see what sort of prospect my room enjoyed, that it would command an excellent view of the graveyard. But nonetheless, the sight of a sea of headstones splashed with moonbeams came as something of a minor shock. This was, of course, quite unwarranted. In a building situated so near the church it served, there would naturally be many chambers which enjoyed this view, and mine was but one of them. Besides, if I wished to avoid it, I needed only draw the curtains again. Yet the night was so breathlessly hot, and the air in the room so close and thick, that I could not bear the thought of sleeping with the windows latched. Accordingly, having unpacked my valise, hung up tomorrow's clothes neatly in the small wardrobe next to my bed, and laid out my brushes and shaving case upon the dressing table, I crossed and pulled the drapes on both windows fully open. Clouds had wandered across the face of the moon, leaving only a pinched sliver of white, and for this I gave thanks. It was trying enough to attempt sleep in this torrid heat, yet alone in a bedroom flooded with brightness. I fumbled at the antique casements until at last they yielded, and threw the mullioned windows wide, the better to admit any whisper of a breeze which might have wound its way through the dense trees of Weniston Hill opposite. But not an atom of air stirred in the stagnant night. There was a candlestick upon my bedside table, and I resolved, despite the lateness of the hour, to beguile Morpheus with a little reading, for I had never yet found myself so wakeful that a few pages of closely printed text by the faint light of a candle could not persuade my eyelids to droop. I took up my little volume of ghost stories again, but somehow, in the eerie stillness of the night, rather than the bird-bright sunshine of afternoon, I no longer cared for them. Accordingly, I rescued my neglected academic book. It was a treatise on Flemish history, I believe. Yet even that worthy tome could not dull my senses to the point of slumber. I tossed both books on the bed, jumped up from my chair, and paced about, wondering how I might sedate my overtaxed brain. It was trying enough to keep satyrs, demons, and what did Oxborough call them? Woodwoses from leaping betwixt my mind's eye and the page. Perhaps I ought rather to gaze upon the tranquil scenery of Suffolk before me, if it was restfulness I craved. I hit upon the capital notion of smoking a cigar and drinking a dram or two of whisky to aid my appreciation of the landscape, reasoning that the wide-flung windows would dissipate any fumes before morning. Accordingly, I helped myself to a generous measure of single malt from the hunting flask in my valise, and plucked the leather cigar case from my jacket pocket. I hesitated, then cast off the jacket, and, impulsively, my sweat-damp shirt after it. The relief from the cloying heat was inexpressible, and I felt 100-fold better in an instant, so good, indeed, that in an uncharacteristic access of slovenliness, I left both garments splayed upon the carpet just where they fell. Thus, half-naked in vest and trousers, did I sit in my chair beside the window, stare out into starlit obscurity, and commence to smoke the most informal cigar I had ever enjoyed, complemented by restorative nips at my whisky flask. The viscous warmth of the air, even at this late hour, sheened every inch of skin with a film of perspiration. Any movement was an effort, and even my brain seemed heat-drunk and sluggish. The intermittent clouds had bred and clotted, perhaps, I prayed, portending rain. And at last my exhausted mind fell to idling as I contemplated the overcast prospect, almost as it had before the doom. For some little time, I cannot say how long, I must have hovered at the brink between sleep and waking, thinking and dreaming, without knowing I had arrived there. Then, suddenly, I was alert as a cat. I could not tell what, if anything, had roused me from my trance-like stupor, but my every sense sang sharp as a struck wine-glass. I glanced about me in alarm, thinking each moment to find something terribly amiss. And yet there was nothing, or nothing that I could see. Slowly I rose from my chair, listening, watching, waiting. Muscles taut, my whole body cocked like a pistol. The moon had retreated still farther behind her veil of cloud, and it was blacker and quieter without than before. No chuck or coo of bird nor sigh of wind carried across the churchyard. Even the rich scents of the countryside seemed to have been parched from the oven-hot atmosphere. I stared down into the silent cemetery, its motionless throng of headstones, mere ghosts of themselves, shades in a deeper gloom, its neat paths greyed by feeble starlight. Nothing stirred. Not an insect in the withered grass, not a leaf upon the desiccated boughs which gathered beyond the boundary walls. I was forced to conclude that I had imagined the disturbance, whatever it was. Perhaps my unaccustomed whisky nightcap had got the better of me. Looking down at the cigar still clutched in my fingers, I saw that it was quite out. yet I did not remember finishing it. Surely, though my eyes had not closed, I must have slept in all but name. It was well past time to retire to bed, I decided, and made to discard the cigar end. Something moved beyond the window. I was watchful again in an instant, leaning half out to scan the scene. Nothing but black and pewter, a charcoal sketch of stillness. Impossible to detect darkness moving against darkness in this tenebrous night. I needed to accustom my eyes. I crossed, blew out the guttering candle on the dresser, and the last light for miles about was extinguished. Back at the window, I stood concealed behind a curtain, lest any slight movement betray my vigil to whatever prowled below. I was curious now, and a little afraid. I could not have said why. Nothing that was down there could harm me up here if it had not wings. And yet it seemed of the utmost importance to stay out of view. Not sight, but sound drew me to the thing eventually. A low, barely perceptible, snuffling and rustling drifted from the eastern quarter of the churchyard, which lay to the right of me. I recalled that Oxborough, tarrying there, had complained about the burial gifts left upon recent interments. And it was from this very same plot that the noises originated. Staring harder, straining my vision into the grainy, shifting dark, I thought with a thrill of horror that I descried a figure crouched atop the heaped earth of a new grave. Yet it was not the silhouette of a dog or fox, as I had half suspected. The shape was human, and unmistakably man-sized, though it went on all fours like a beast. Its hackles were up, and it seemed to be sniffing and digging at something. Rootling like a truffle pig was the absurd and hideous comparison that first struck me. Every hair upon my body lifted up at once and quivered like quills upon the fretful porpentine. I did not mean to call out, but my voice leapt unbidden from my lips, strident with the force of terror.
"Who are you, sir, to trespass here?" I cried.
"Sir?" For that brute, that horrid hunch thing, I admonished myself. And yet, with such a shape, such a size, what else could it be but a man? Some dreadfully debased, desperate, mad fellow, perhaps, but a man nonetheless. Had I detected the flutter of ragged garments at its shoulders and thighs, or was that merely an illusion of the shadows? Darkness confounded me. I could not say what I had seen. At my shout, the figure froze instantly in the lee of the gleaming headstone, still as a wild beast suddenly startled. Again the queer conundrum struck me that its form was human, yet its actions were animal through and through. An atavistic instinct, either to flee or fight, was its only compass, I suspected, and hope rose in my cantering heart that a show of aggression might put the awful creature to flight. I yelled out again, with all the strength at my command, "Begone, in God's name!" A violent motion suddenly quelled, a pulsing hesitation behind the gravestone. Then the intruder took flight, dashing towards the tree line with an incredible turn of speed. I have hunted, and I have raced. I have seen horse, dog, and fox strive for swiftness when the whip's lash or the hound's yelps draw near, yet I have never in my life seen anything, man nor beast, move so fast as that creature did. In a matter of seconds, it had cleared the intervening tombstones and attained the low, solid wall that encircled the cemetery. It flowed. I declare, that is the only word. Like black water over the wall. Then it paused a moment and half turned. In that instant, the moon cast off her grey shroud, and the whole broad swathe of holy ground between our two figures was bathed in what seemed to my dazzled eyes the raw glare of day. Every stone stood stark above its black shadow, and so did he. What I had taken for tattered clothes was revealed to my astonishment as some kind of suit of rough fur. In the ghastly light, his eyes glinted like an animal's, as though silvered behind, yet there was something appallingly human in them. Those eyes knew me, and I them, for they were filled with the same haunted desperation which had gazed out from the eyes of the doomed devils in the painting. The creature stared at me for half a breath, no more. And then it bolted for the shelter of the trees and was gone. A thin, dust sheet cloud billowed over the moon again, and I'd discovered I was shuddering uncontrollably, even in the night's merciless heat. What I had just seen, surely it could not have happened. Had I experienced some awful dreamlike reverie, some hallucinatory whiskey nightmare? There was no way to know how much time had elapsed. I had not consulted my watch before I sat down to smoke. I felt dizzy and fuddled, as if my poor aching head would spin off if I moved too abruptly or thought too hard about what I had witnessed. And yet, had I actually seen anything? The whole episode was so sinister, so bizarre, yet so utterly real, that I wondered again whether it had been one of those queer waking visions which tease us the very precipice of sleep. I recalled dousing my candle, and it was out, sure enough, but the breeze now toying with the curtains could have accomplished that. I turned back reluctantly to the window. The graveyard outside was entirely still and silent, seemingly quite undisturbed. I could hardly keep my eyes open now, though, and so, having shut fast both casements and pulled tight the curtains, I dragged myself wearily to bed.